From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is reporter and co-host of VOA's Africa News Tonight, Kim Lewis. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. February is Black History Month in the United States. The annual month-long national observance pays tribute to important people and events that shape the history of African Americans. On this edition of the program, we shine the spotlight on one of America's leading organizations, which seeks to fight discrimination against minorities by promoting fair housing and community development, equal employment opportunity, voting rights, equal educational opportunity, criminal justice reform, and more. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Kristen Clark. She's president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Throughout her career, Clark has focused on work that seeks to strengthen U.S. democracy by combating discrimination faced by African Americans and other marginalized communities. Ms. Clark formerly served as the head of the Civil Rights Bureau for the New York State Attorney. She also spent several years at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, where she helped lead the organization's work in the areas of voting rights and election law across the country. Ms. Clark worked on cases defending the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act and also testified before Congress and state legislatures. Ms. Clark has also worked at the U.S. Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division. There, she served as a federal prosecutor in the criminal section of the division, handling police misconduct, police brutality, hate crimes, and human trafficking cases. She also worked on voting rights and redistricting cases through the division's voting section. And Kristen Clark joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
And as always, I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Kim Lewis.
Thanks, Carol. Nice to be here.
Well, Kristen, first I'd like you to talk a bit about what your organization does, its goals, the Lawyers Committee.
The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law is one of our country's most important civil rights organizations. We stand on the front lines in the work that remains to be done to fulfill the goals of the civil rights movement in all areas of life. We work to combat ongoing housing discrimination faced by African Americans and other minority groups, employment discrimination. We work to promote equal educational opportunity for all of our kids. We work to promote smart criminal justice reforms and to tackle and address the racial disparities and problems that we see across our criminal justice system. And most significantly, we work to secure access to the ballot box for all Americans. We want to make sure that all voters are able to freely cast a ballot and participate in our political process across the country.
Kristen, that's a tall order. Many might say, well, it's been many years since the Civil Rights Act has been, you know, passed. We have an African-American president. But obviously, there are still many, many disparities, as you know. In what area do you see the biggest challenges, whether it's housing discrimination, employment, criminal justice? What are your biggest challenges today?
We certainly have made great progress as a nation, but events that we witness every day make plain that in the criminal justice area, we continue to see some very real and significant problems. What's wonderful is that people are using smartphone technology to shine a spotlight on problems that we have long known have existed, but are now shining a spotlight on those problems in ways that the whole country can see. So policing reform and working to address the racial disparities across our criminal justice system, it's one of the greatest challenges that we face today as a nation and one of the areas where the Lawyers Committee is very focused on doing some real work.
Let me turn to my colleague, Kim Lewis, for a question.
It seems almost hypocritical that in a time when we have more interracial marriages and more mixed families than ever before, that racial tensions still persist. So what do you think are the root causes of today's racial tensions? Or is it the same feeling that people have had for 100 years that it's just permeating through to today?
I think we have to acknowledge the great progress that we've made as a nation. We are not living in the 1960s, and the stark racial tensions that used to play out on our streets in the 60s, I mean, that's not a moment that we're living in today. We've seen great progress. However, there are problems that persist, and one of the most significant problems that we are living with today are the racial tensions that result when police engage in excessive use of force against minority communities. African Americans make up 13% of the U.S. population, but 37% of the prison population in the U.S. And we know that those rates are the result of disproportionate and sometimes unnecessary contact between police and minority communities, the over-policing of minority communities. And what results from that over-policing is a lot of racial tension. And that is a real problem that we're living with today in 2016 that needs to be addressed.
And growing up myself in Baltimore City, I've seen a lot of how people interact with police officers. And statistically speaking, when you look at crime, there are more African Americans who are killing African Americans than police officers killing African Americans. In the news, they highlight how white police officers kill black people. What can an African American person do so that they are not put in such a position for a police officer to always target them? Is it something that African American, especially male, can do?
One, I think it is very important to take a step back and look at who do we incarcerate in the United States. And the reality is that we have grave numbers of nonviolent offenders and people with no criminal history filling jails and prisons across our nation. Nearly one-third of federal prisoners are people with no criminal history or little criminal history to speak of. Our jails and prisons are filled with, you know, people who use drugs, and we should think about whether incarcerating those peoples is the right way to deal with that issue. We incarcerate people for minor drug possession. We really need officers to focus on combating real crime. I mean, you were talking about black-on-black crime earlier. And look, crime is a reality that we contend with in this country and in every country across the globe. And we need to make sure that police officers are focused on truly promoting public safety and working to address real crime and not unnecessarily entangling individuals in the criminal justice system merely because of the color of their skin. Tamir Rice, a young boy who was playing in the park, he certainly had no criminal history to speak of. But we live in a world today in the United States in which police officers over-police minority communities, over-police communities of color, and the resulting racial tension is not surprising.
Kristen Clark, President Obama also noted that today's criminal justice system remains particularly skewed by race and by wealth. And of course, this has adverse ripple effects on our country's families and communities. We're hearing this topic being discussed by both Democratic and Republican candidates for president, the need to reform the criminal justice system. Where does your organization, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, stand with respect to the need for criminal justice reform, and what are some of your suggestions?
We support criminal justice reform. We need criminal justice reform. And I am very heartened by a lot of the bipartisan attention that I think this issue is now getting in many states across our country and getting at the federal level. I think states are taking a step back and realizing that we're spending far too much money locking people up for nonviolent offenses and really thinking about how we can better use those resources to prevent the problem of incarceration in the first place. So we fully support the criminal justice reform bill that now sits before Congress and are doing work in many areas to address many of the disparities that we see. Barriers to reentry for people with criminal backgrounds is one area where we are focusing a great deal of time and attention. When people come out of jails and prisons, they encounter barriers at every turn. Barriers with respect to accessing jobs, accessing housing, having the ability to enroll in school, accessing the ballot box on election day. We need to work to ensure that when people leave our jails and prisons, they are able to successfully reintegrate into their communities. I believe deeply that once someone has paid their debt to society, they deserve a second chance and should be given the ability and resources to get back on their feet. That is the way that we prevent recidivism and prevent this problem of people cycling back in to jails and prison.
Speaking about another approach to reducing recidivism, one of my colleagues in the VOA newsroom said that studies have shown that prison rehabilitation programs, both inside the prison and after, do not necessarily lower recidivism rates. Do you agree with that, or do you have an opinion about what would work specifically?
The studies that we have seen show that, you know, if somebody is able to come out and get a job, if somebody is able to come out and get access to housing, the likelihood that they will end up back in jail is substantially reduced. The New York Times published a very important piece looking at the returns that we get from spending money providing an education to folks who are imprisoned. And the studies that were reported on show that we save $4 to $5 in reprisonment costs for every $1 that we spend on providing an education, a college education to inmates. So I believe very deeply in giving people the resources and the ability and the things that they need to bounce back and get back on their feet.
But is this something that only states can do? State laws and regulations?
State laws, but the federal government plays a very important role. We need officials at the top championing smart criminal justice reform policies and taking legislative action that incentivizes states to do the right thing and to put in place reforms inside jails and prisons that work on the ground. So at the end of the day, this message has to come from the top.
Well, speaking of which, Kristen, criminal justice reform has traditionally been more of a Democratic rallying cry, that is, on the Democratic side. But now it is taking on, as you alluded to earlier, a more bipartisan flair, particularly in Congress among many Republicans. Why do you think this is happening? And do you see this as a very promising trend?
The experiment in mass incarceration that we have been engaged with over the last 20 years has been a failed experiment. In 1994, Congress authorized a bill that incentivized the growth of the prison industrial complex that we have witnessed explode in the U.S. over the past 20 years. The 1994 crime bill authorized $12.5 billion to states to increase incarceration. And that bill is what incentivized many states to start cultivating jails and prisons. And we saw, unsurprisingly, a dramatic rise in prison populations. And I think today, states have taken a step back and realized that this was a waste of resources. You know, states need resources for other important needs and priorities, such as education and health care. And the amount of money that we have spent incarcerating people for low-level offenses just doesn't make sense anymore. So I think this bipartisan moment that we are witnessing in our country is encouraging, heartening, and largely the result of people realizing that this was a real waste of resources.
The empirical data showed that. Well, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Kristen Clark. She's president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law here in Washington, D.C. I'm Carol Castiel, along with reporter and co-host of VOA's Africa News Tonight, Kim Lewis. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout-out to a Facebook fan from Angola, Nilson Jirinho. Please send your feedback via email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on Facebook. Well, now I'll turn to my colleague, Kim Lewis, for another question.
Kristen, we're in a presidential election year here in the United States. What would you like to see the presidential candidates focus on as civil rights and human rights advocate? What would you like to see them address and offer solutions for?
That's a great question. First, I'll say we're a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We do not endorse political candidates or engage in electioneering, but I think it is incredibly important for all of the presidential candidates on both sides of the aisle to be focused on the grave civil rights issues that plague us as a nation. Criminal justice reform, of course, tops that list. Working to promote voting rights and increase access to the ballot box, I think, also must be an important priority. During the midterm elections in 2014, we saw the lowest turnout rate that we have seen in more than 70 years in this country. Just a little over 30% of eligible Americans turned out to vote. And I think that's shameful. We need a president who is going to champion strong voting rights reform and work to incentivize states to take steps that get more eligible Americans out to the polls on Election Day.
I'd like to follow up on that, Kristen, on voting rights and access to the ballot box. We've seen, once again, many states across the country trying, or at least via certain requirements with respect to a voter ID. We see many states either overtly or inadvertently limiting access to the ballot box. And as always, these attempts generally have an adverse and disproportionate impact on minority voters. Where do we stand regarding voting rights, access to the ballot box? What are your observations about what states are doing? And what are the challenges that we face in making voting accessible for all? And let's say easier. And let me just add one more thing. People look at the United States, a robust democracy, and they're sort of puzzled because whether in Brazil or other even developing countries, people can vote either in advance, the day of, any time of the day or night. And here we have some restrictions. Why is that?
Our nation's most important federal civil rights law has, I think, without question, been the Voting Rights Act of 1965. This was a law adopted by Congress at a time that marked the heyday of the civil rights movement, at a time where we saw peaceful civil rights demonstrators being beaten in the streets fighting for the right to vote. And this law has done a tremendous work to provide greater access to our democratic process by providing the tools needed to combat voting discrimination, poll taxes and literacy tests, and all kinds of obstructive tactics that were adopted, particularly in the southern states, to exclude African Americans and other minority voters from the ballot box. Fast forward to the modern era, and we're now living in a moment where the Supreme Court has issued a ruling gutting a core provision of the Voting Rights Act. And in the very states where we've seen the Voting Rights Act do a tremendous amount of work across the years to combat discrimination, we're now seeing backsliding and seeing a resurgence of discrimination in those states. Texas and North Carolina, I think, are the poster children of voter suppression. On the day that the Supreme Court issued its ruling gutting the preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act, which is a provision that had basically served as a preemptive strike to states when they sought to implement bad and restrictive voting rules. The afternoon that the Supreme Court issued its ruling, Texas announced that it was moving forward with a mandatory photo ID requirement for voters. This is a very burdensome, discriminatory, and unnecessary law that basically requires all voters to present certain government-issued photo ID at the time they're voting. Now, why is this problematic? The data shows that there are certain minority communities that are without access to the limited categories of photo ID that are acceptable. So in Texas, for example, a gun license qualifies as acceptable photo ID, but a student ID does not. What's motivating these laws is clear. It is clear that these are efforts to lock out and exclude certain voters from our process, and this is deeply problematic and very anti-democratic, and I think one of the biggest issues that we're living with today.
Well, this is very disturbing, and of course you bring up the Supreme Court, and we acknowledge just last week the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. This is a huge issue now in the presidential campaign. President Obama has vowed to nominate a Supreme Court justice, even though many members of Congress, mostly Republican, and all the Republican candidates for the presidency have said they're opposed to this. What's at stake, Kristen Clark?
Democracy is at stake. At the end of the day, the U.S. Supreme Court is one of our core branches of government. It is one of the most important parts of our government and our system of checks and balances. You know, our Constitution calls for the president to play his role as the executive, chief executive, calls for Congress to play its role as the legislative branch, and then calls for the Supreme Court to play its role as the lead judiciary in our nation. And that Supreme Court is tasked with the grave responsibility of resolving important cases and controversies that come before it, important cases that touch on every aspect of American life, civil rights issues, criminal justice issues, health issues, economic justice issues. I mean, you name it, the Supreme Court hears incredibly important cases. And in order for that branch of government to operate effectively, we need the president to exercise his constitutional obligation to nominate someone to fill that seat.
Well, let's be clear, though, the politics involved here, and we have now a Supreme Court that's split in half, four more liberal justices and four more conservative-leaning. And, of course, Antonin Scalia, who just passed away, was a conservative justice. So there is a lot more at stake than just the general principles that you discussed. It's really about which way cases could go in the future. So that's why it's so critical.
Absolutely.
And may I just interject? I just wanted to add in, President George W. Bush was in a similar position that President Barack Obama is in now, and he wanted to name another Supreme Court justice, and Congress did not allow him to do that. So do you think that they should abide by what they did with Bush and just wait until a new president is elected, or should President Obama be allowed to go ahead?
Six justices have been confirmed in presidential election years in the modern era. There was Justice Kennedy, who was appointed by Ronald Reagan and confirmed by Congress in February of a presidential election year, and Justice Murphy, who was nominated and confirmed during a presidential election year, and numerous others. The precedent shows in the modern era a pattern of presidents stepping forth and exercising their constitutional prerogative to fill that seat on the court. And we don't want to live through two Supreme Court terms with a court that is not sufficiently staffed to hear the cases that come before it. I think it is incredibly important that we preserve the important stature of the Supreme Court, which has been one that's always been above the political gamesmanship and partisan wrangling. And very important that President Obama, with two terms left in 2016 and a lot of work to do resolving cases that sit on the court's docket, very important that the president quickly move to name a nominee and for Congress to do its work, studying the background of that nominee and then moving forward with a confirmation vote.
Yes, and I just wanted to change the atmosphere just a little bit and talk about social media and its role in actually in history now, because looking back, it's going to be part of American history, and it has been used to mobilize people to demonstrate, to protest, to overthrow governments. We had the Arab Spring that started back in December of 2010. Social media was used in the rioting in Baltimore back in April, where the teenagers were tweeting each other as to when and where they were going to start, I guess if you want to call it, the destruction of businesses. So what role do you see social media having in the future regarding the shaping of history and influencing people in their actions.
It has been fantastic to see the productive ways that citizens are using social media to shine a spotlight on the problems that play out on our streets. We're almost generating a generation of citizen journalists, if you will, right, who are documenting and sharing stories in real-time fashion with their phones. I think it is encouraging. I think it is empowering. I think that it has helped to promote the robust dialogue that we are finally seeing around criminal justice issues in our country. The sad reality is that police brutality and the deaths of unarmed civilians has been an issue that we've lived with for a very long time in this country. But people are finally taking a step back and realizing that this is a real issue. It's not an imagined issue, that we have video that's capturing, you know, what's happening and what's transpiring. At the end of the day, people are out there exercising their First Amendment rights, and I think it's a wonderful thing for our democracy.
Conversely, Kristen, on the question or the issue of crime and the criminal justice system, some say that the problem of crime in the African American community in particular stems from the breakup of home structure, and that something needs to be done to forge a more cohesive and more economically viable family life from childhood on. What's your take on that?
Economic viability. I think that's incredibly important. Economic empowerment, working to provide a living wage, elevating the minimum wage so that families can sustain healthy homes, providing health care to people. I think that government plays a very important role in helping to ensure that families can stick together and withstand the storm and, you know, provide a healthy life for their children. So I think government plays a very important role here.
So government is the key driver, in your view, with respect to helping to sustain the American family, and in particular the African American family.
And creating the conditions that can give families a chance to succeed and thrive.
Absolutely. We were talking about two-way streets here. There's not any one factor or measure that's going to be the magic bullet. Right, Kim?
That is true. And I guess, and also you have to look at when you're talking about families, and of course a family is made up of different things. It doesn't always have to be a mother and a father. And it could be a family is a family who is living in that home. And you want to make sure that family values are instilled within the home, because I think that's very, very important too. And that is something that whoever the head of the household is, and I don't know if you would agree with this, Kristen, or not, that they should help to instill that in the children. Because when you grow up with values and a sense of self-worth and knowing the difference between right and wrong, it just makes you more of a productive person out in the world.
I agree with that. As a mother with an 11-year-old boy, I work very hard. But my most important job is as a mother and instilling in my son the importance of respecting differences, of treating adults with respect, taking school seriously. So I agree with you that those kind of bedrock principles start in the home. But I think at the end of the day, when you open the doors, that government plays a very important role in making sure that we have healthy communities, strong schools, good workplaces where people can thrive. You know, I think all of these things go hand in hand in making our world more secure.
Kristen Clark is president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Well, Kristen Clark, thank you for coming in and sharing your unique and interesting perspective with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Rick Pantaleo, and joining me on the program was Kim Lewis, co-host of VOA's Africa News Tonight. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.